This country is at war with Germany.
Hallo zusammen und damit herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg. Mein Name ist Raffaela Höfner. In diesem Podcast spreche ich mit ehemaligen Soldaten, US-Veteranen, Überlebenden und Opfern des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Hört aus erster Hand die Erlebnisse, Schrecken und Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben. Hier geht es um den Tatort Zweiter Weltkrieg. Ein Podcast gegen das Vergessen und für den Frieden. Dezember 1944. Hürtgenwald. Kälte frisst sich wie ein ausgehungertes Tier durch meine Kleidung. Seit Stunden kauere ich in diesem gottverdammten Foxhole und warte. Warte auf den Angriff der Deutschen. Warte darauf, dass unsere Infanterie wieder losbellt. Bei jedem Schatten zucke ich zusammen. Bei diesen eisigen Temperaturen hat man kaum die Möglichkeit zu schlafen. Ich habe Angst, dass mir die Finger oder Zehen einfrieren und sie abbrechen wie morsches Holz. Das Klappern meiner Zähne ist so laut, dass einer aus dem Graben neben mir kurz den Kopf hebt. Hier ist es so kalt, dass ich schon dreimal auf mein Gewehr pissen musste, damit es nicht einfriert. Ruf mir mein Kamerad zu. Seine runde Nase erinnert mich an eine reife Brombeere. Wie lange soll das noch so weitergehen? Wir alle sind erschöpft, müde und ausgelaugt. Mit allem haben wir gerechnet, aber niemals mit einem so grausamen und erbarmungslosen Winter. Die Deutschen kennen diese Gegend hier wie ihre Westentasche, während wir nicht auf das vorbereitet waren. Wann haben wir jemals eine Schlacht in einem Wald geführt? Ich habe meine Stiefel schon dreimal ausgezogen und die tauben Füße massiert. Ruft mir der Kamerad wieder zu. Schau lieber mal nach, ob deine Zehen schon schwarz sind. Kälte und Krieg. Scheinbar untrennbar miteinander verbunden. Hast du gehört, dass sie einen von der SS geschnappt haben? Ein richtig arroganter Pinsel war das. Er hat gesagt, dass Dutzende Königstiger und Panther im Anmarsch sind und sie uns abschießen werden wie die Spatzen. Kein Witz? Wenn ich's dir doch sage. Die kann man beschießen, wie man will. Die bekommen nicht mal den Kratzer ab. Die Panzerung der Tiger ist undurchdringbar. Wie aber sollen sie durch den Wald pflügen? Ein Auf und Ab, durch das Dickicht der Bäume, unmöglich. Aber aus ihren unsichtbaren Bunkern muss man immer damit rechnen, dass einen ein Maschinengewehr niedermäht. Gab schon was zu essen? Mir knurrt der Magen. Vor so 4 Stunden etwa. Ich kann diese gottverdammten Bohnen ohnehin nicht mehr essen. Außerdem sind die eiskalt, bis einer der Jungs die Töpfe vorgebracht hat. Ich habe seit Stunden nichts mehr zwischen die Zähne bekommen, murre ich. Der General meint, dass den Krauts bei der Treibstoff und die Munition ausgehen wird. Die Luftwaffe kommt hier sowieso niemals durch. Die Bäume stehen viel zu dicht. Nachschub für uns wäre besser. Ja, frische Männer wären gut. Da ist jemand, rufe ich aus und sehe die Bewegung aus dem Augenwinkel. Sofort sind meine Nerven wie Drahtseile gespannt. 2 Silhouetten rennen auf uns zu. Dahinter und davor dichte Bäume. Chino und Peacock? Die beiden Männer rennen durch den tiefen Schnee. Rutschen, rappeln sich hoch, rennen schneller. Ihr Atem hängt als Wolke über ihnen. Hier, hier! Brülle ich ihnen zu. Der Schnee ist so hell, dass man von Weitem nicht sehen kann. Keines der Löcher, keine Stellung oder auch Feinde. Plötzlich Artilleriefeuer. Baumwipfel explodieren und es regnet Holzsplitter auf uns herab. Der Himmel beginnt zu glühen. Ich vergesse die Kälte und greife nach meiner Waffe. Down, down, brülle ich. Chino und Peacock werfen sich in den Schnee. Wieder blitzt der Horizont im Osten auf. Granaten springen Eisklumpen meterhoch in die Luft. Stay in your holes, hold the fire. Wieder schlagen Granaten ein. Schreie werden laut. Sie haben eins unserer Löcher getroffen. Medic, Medic! Wir müssen uns. Ein Schuss zischt durch die Luft und trifft den Kameraden, mit dem ich mich vor einer Minute noch unterhalten habe, mit voller Wucht in den Hals. Überall Blut. Er ist tot, bevor er den Boden berührt. Unsere Maschinengewehre antworten. Man down! Brüllt einer. Fire! Eine erneute Explosion bringt den Boden zum Beben. Die Bäume geben uns zwar Schutz, doch auch die Deutschen können so verdeckt auf uns schießen. Als die feindlichen Soldaten aus dem Wald nach vorne sprengen, fasse ich mein Gewehr und lade durch. Jetzt nur keine Ladehemmung. Ein Deutscher fällt, dann noch einer. Maschinengewehr! Unser Posten rattert los. I'm hit! Ruft einer der Männer. Unser Maschinengewehr mäht Dutzende innerhalb von Sekunden nieder. Rauch erschwert die Sicht. Dann herrscht Stille. They're moving back! Höre ich ein Schreien. Ich spitze die Ohren. Tatsächlich. Der Schnee schluckt ihre Schritte. Sie machen sich tatsächlich aus dem Staub. Vielleicht hatten sie nicht mit dem Maschinengewehr gerechnet. Ich zittere am ganzen Körper. Wie lange werden wir wohl noch die Kraft haben, hier durchzuhalten? In dieser Folge spreche ich mit Larry Howe. Larry wurde im März 1925 in Massachusetts geboren und diente während des Zweiten Weltkriegs in der US-Armee. Er meldet sich im Juli 1943 zum Dienst und absolviert eine Grundausbildung im Fort Bragg in North Carolina. Harry wird im Dezember 1943 nach Europa verschifft und landet am Strand in der Normandie, um der 4. Division beizutreten. Er dient dort als Funker für eine Gruppe von Stürmerbeobachtern. Nachdem er sich am 25. Juni 1944 die Halbinsel Cherbourg gesichert hat, reist er nach Paris, also nach Frankreich, und betritt die Stadt am 25. August 1944 als einer der ersten Amerikaner, die das tun. Von Paris folgt seine Division den Deutschen zur Siegfriedlinie nach Deutschland. Vom 7. November bis 11. Dezember 1944 ist er Teil der Schlacht im Hürtgenwald, wo er sich eine Beinverletzung zuzieht. Am 29. März 1945 überquert Larry den Rhein und überquert später am 25. April auch die Donau, nachdem seine Division am weitesten nach Deutschland eingedrungen ist. Im Mai 1945 wird er in die Staaten zurückgeschickt und nach einem 35-tägigen Urlaub an Fort Devens zurückgeschickt. Larry ist noch im Fort Devens, als der Tag des Sieges über Japan am 15. August 1945 angekündigt wird. Und kurz darauf wird er entlassen. Larry verbringt sein ziviles Leben für den Boston Herald Traveler. Leider ist Harry im April diesen Jahres mit 99 Jahren verstorben. Das macht seine Geschichte nun umso wertvoller. Hör noch jetzt rein das Interview, um Larrys Erzählungen aus erster Hand zu erfahren. Das Interview in dieser Folge ist auf Englisch.
Okay, it's all the way.
How's that sound?
It's good. Where do you guys live?
We live in North Carolina.
Okay, I talked to Ed Cottrell like a couple of months before.
Okay, oh yes, well.
That's so
now
cool.
Now you are a reporter, is that it?
I'm a writer. I just finished my third book here. It's like a novel. It's
yes.
You see Auschwitz in the background, the concentration camp.
Ah.
Yes.
And it's in German, of course.
Yes, it's in German.
Yeah. Well.
Well, it's like a few
questions. Do you have questions for me?
Yes, of course. I would like to know if you could give me a short or brief biography of yourself. When you were born and where?
Okay, I was born in Massachusetts and lived in a little town outside of Boston called Watertown.
I know Boston, but I don't know Watertown.
Well, right outside of Boston.
3825.
March 8th, 1925. So I'm 98 years old.
Okay. That's a good age.
Yeah. Now, what else can I answer?
Yeah. You, Like, how did you grow up there, and what did you experience, or when the war started?
Okay, when I grew up in the Depression, I started to work on selling newspapers on the street at age 10.
Oh, okay.
And about at age 12, I began delivering newspapers at homes.
How much was a newspaper this time? How much money?
It was 2 cents.
What?
And you could get all 6 days, morning or night, for 13 cents a week, 12 cents for the papers, and a penny a delivery charge.
Okay, that's sounds cheap in like in our time now.
That was the 1930s.
Yeah.
And then I got out of high school in 1943. And I went into the service and went over, had my basic training in late 43 and then went over.
Did you volunteer or did you like had to go to army?
Well, I was drafted.
Okay, so you volunteered and you wanted to go or was everyone had to go?
We had to go.
We were
conscripted, yes.
And which training camp did you go to?
Fort Bragg in North Carolina.
Okay, so it was close.
Yeah, well, but we haven't lived here long. We've lived here 10 years or so.
Okay.
We've lived all over the country, the two of us.
And how did the training look like when you went to training camp?
Well, there was a lot of walking, you know, and I was trained in the artillery.
Okay.
I went ashore in Normandy on D-Day. My job changed the minute I got ashore, because one of the boat bringing the artillery pieces in was hit a bomb, hit
okay.
a mine.
So you went in on D-Day like June 6th.
Yes.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
How did you experience this day?
Well, my job changed the minute I got in because we had lost some folks going in. And because I had the artillery training, they assigned me a job as what they call a forward observer. In other words, I was up with the infantry directing fire on the guns that were some back 3 or 4 or 5 miles back.
Okay, so did you stay on the ship or do you have to like leave the ship and go into the beach?
Left the ship, went into the beach, and then I stayed with the artillery, with the infantry, directing artillery fire.
Okay. Do you know the movie about the soldier named James Ryan, where Tom Hanks plays the part and Matt Damon? It's based on it's happening on June 6th. And so you see in the movie how this day looked like on camera and it was tough.
I'm not a movie goer.
Okay. So how do you experience it? I couldn't believe like anyone could come through because the Germans were like sitting and shooting with the machine guns and it was so hard to get off the ship.
Yes, it was, and but there were so many of us that, a lot of us made it, and some of us didn't.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
We landed at what's called Utah Beach.
Yeah.
And then our objective was to go around and capture the Port of Cherbourg so that the heavier equipment like tanks could come in. So that was our first response, our first responsibility. And then after that, we were assigned what was called the breakout at St. Lo, which occurred we captured Cherbourg on the 25th of June. On the 25th of July, we broke out at St. Lo. 25th of August, we entered Paris.
Which company were you
the 4th Infantry Division, and we went in with the 2nd French Armored Division.
Okay, so you were one of the first companies getting into Paris.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, crazy.
I was in the 3rd vehicle. The 1st vehicle was a tank. 2nd vehicle was loaded with infantry. And then I was in a Jeep because I had a radio.
Okay. How did you experience this? How was, like, the French people? Did you, like, get welcomings or...?
Overwhelming.
Yeah.
Overwhelming.
Did you find any Germans, or were they just getting back into, like, leaving Paris already?
No, we were in Paris a couple of days. But then we just kept going and kept up going up through the Ardennes, and our division, the 4th Division, was the first division to hit German soil. We went up through Ardennes into Bastogne and Belgium.
Which date? Yeah.
Pardon me?
Which date are you talking about? Like when you hit Bastogne?
September of 1944.
Oh, you were pretty early then. The Battle of the Bulge didn't start yet.
No, the Battle of the Bulge didn't come for some time. No,
yeah.
The toughest battle we had after that was what's called the Hürtgen Forest. Well, it was a very heavy forest, about a mile thick, that we had to get through to get to the Cologne plain so we could cross the Rhine River. So we did that for, a month, something. I don't know, it was a long time.
Can you remember a special, like, day or something what happened in those battles?
Oh, Lord, yes. I was wounded early on, not badly. And in fact, I was only out for 2 or 3 days, and I was back again.
How did it happen? How did you get wounded?
Well, our very first day at the Hürtgen, we were held up by a barbed wire entanglement. And in order to break through that barbed wire, we needed what was called a... What?
Bangalore
torpedo.
Okay.
But we didn't have one, so we decided, we were told to dig in for the night. And the lieutenant that was my boss, I was a radio operator, and I were digging a hole, and we were hit with a...
Torpedo.
No, well, wasn't a torpedo, but anyway, what was it? You put it in just drop it in and shoots out. My lieutenant and I were digging a hole, and it dropped on his side, so he was hit from his neck to his ankle, and my assistant was a heavy woodsman from Michigan, so he carried the lieutenant on his back, and then I had the two radios, and we dropped him off at an aid station and then called for replacements, and I went back and it took care of me. And then we fought this forest in this forest for 30 days.
I know the forest name. I just wasn't familiar with the English word. It's a bit different in German. Now,
yes,
Hürtgenwald. Yeah, Hürtgen Forest. It's close to Aachen, right in the Eifel.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Could you tell us what the forest looked like? Was it like closed trees or like wide standing?
Very thick, heavy trees. So that the most of our shells and the German shells landed in the trees and then, you know, sparked explosion that, you know, the sparks came off the tree.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous.
It was dangerous, yeah.
They no longer know where the Hurricane Forest is, remember, on our trip?
Most of the people don't, but do you know where the Hurricane is?
It's in the west, right, close to Aachen, on the boundary.
Yes.
Close to, yeah.
Right near the Cologne Plain.
Yeah, so it's really close to the different, like, to the west of Germany.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And how was the fighting looking like? You were just, like, sitting in foxholes and waiting for the Germans to attack, and the Germans waited for the U.S. boys to attack, or...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm in my ear.
Is it gone?
No, it's okay. It's blocked for some reason. and that took about a month to go through there. That was very thick forest.
Yeah, I just read that so many people, like so many soldiers on both sides, like lost their lives in this forest.
We had 20,000 casualties.
Yeah.
Then we were sent down near Luxembourg to supposedly get a rest, and that's when the German counteroffensive took, which we held the southern fringe up. We held the southern border of it.
Okay.
And
did you face any Tiger tanks of the Germans?
Any what?
Any, like, Tiger tanks. It's called Tiger. The most powerful tanks of the Germans.
Well, of course, we were all very much afraid of that, the 88.
Okay.
That was a marvelous weapon. I mean, that had ours beat three ways to Sunday. That was a wonderful, I mean, for the Germans, it was a wonderful piece of machinery.
Yeah, it was really dangerous and could shoot had so much power.
And a good long range, and yes, yeah.
What was your job as a radio operator?
Was I?
Your job, what did you have to do as a radio operator? How can I like...
I called a headquarters with the coordination of where we were. And I gave them the coordination so that they knew where we wanted them to shell.
Okay. Can you compare it like being like a signaler? Is it like the same thing?
A
signaler.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, my grandfather was a signaler as well.
We did it by phone.
Okay, my grandfather, he was born in 1921. He was a signaler as well.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, he was in Sarajevo.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end he was fighting in Berlin, like the Battle of Berlin in 45, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's cool. My other grandfather,
he was born in 1921, you say?
Yes. And my other grandfather, he was born 1917, and he was a doctor.
Ah.
He was close to Stalingrad.
Ah, okay. In
crazy times.
Yeah, they were, we were all glad to get it over with.
Yeah, could you just, like, did you have to go forward, like, alone? Because usually signalers have to, like, go in front of the line and to, like, yeah... If something is broken, they have to fix it and send them back where they...
Well, in Normandy, we had to use a telephone rather than a radio because of the close encounter, and they could pick up our signals.
Okay.
And the tanks were... my telephone had very thin wire. In fact, I had a roll on my side, and my phone was in a leather box package, and the tanks kept breaking my wire.
Okay.
then I'd have to go walk along and hold the wire till I found the broken spot, then found the other spot and tried to put them back together.
That's so, crazy.
It was crazy, yes.
Did you experience a personal miracle? Like, or was it your leg injury which you survived?
I don't know whether, no, I think a miracle was I came through.
Okay, yeah, definitely.
I mean, I fought right through to the end.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a miracle that, you know, at the end, neither the German soldiers, the Wehrmacht, nor we didn't want to fight.
Yeah. In the Hürtgen Forest, was there like the Wehrmacht soldiers or was it SS troops stationed?
They were not either. We ran into S troops and Panthers at times, but it was regular Wehrmacht.
Okay, and regular ones.
Yeah. It was just a long time getting there, and then they set us down somewhere down around Luxembourg, I guess it was, and we were supposedly there for a rest, and that's when the counteroffensive came. So we held the southern part of it, and then we're reassigned to go back up through Bastogne and back into Germany again.
How was the weather like in the Hürtgen Forest fighting? Was it pretty cold or rainy or?
Cold and snowy.
Oh, okay. Only September and October already.
This was November.
Oh, November. Okay. That's crazy.
And wet and cold, and you go to sleep in a foxhole that you dug that was dry, and by morning it was wet. So you're sleeping in the water.
Did you guys have enough to eat?
Yeah, but basically enough to do whatever you could carry in your pocket was what you ate that day. You couldn't use fire, so you couldn't heat up the little cans of food. So all we had was what was called K rations. And there was a chocolate bar and a sandwich of some sort. I can't remember.
Okay.
It wasn't much. I went in weighing 138 pounds and I came out weighing 138 pounds.
That's good for you.
Yeah.
Did you lose someone close to you, like in the battle? Like a friend or...
No, not really. There's the guys I trained with.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
So everyone came through. You were lucky.
Yeah. Well, we lost some people along the way, but generally it was an officer we lost as opposed to a doughboy or a... I was a private first class, so I was not very far up the ladder.
Well, what happened after the battle of, like, the Hürtgen Forest? So you went back to Luxembourg and then?
Then that was November. That was December. The battle of the Bulge was... I guess we just keep moving through Germany from that point on.
So you didn't go back to the, like... Belgium and Luxembourg fighting the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, no, because we were at the bottom. We held the bottom base of it.
Okay, so you were like the eastern troops.
Yes.
Okay. And when did you guys cross the Rhine River?
I can't remember.
Must have been early 45 or something like the, maybe in January, February or something like this.
I know we crossed the Rhine, but our entry was up north off of Belgium, in that area up there, so I don't remember personally crossing the Rhine.
Yeah.
I probably did, but I don't remember.
So where have you guys been when the war ended? Have you been into Germany or still in Belgium?
We were down around Nuremberg and Würzburg.
Oh, that's, Nuremberg is like pretty close where I live. It's like 2.5 hours.
Oh, is that right? Well, we were down around Nuremberg when it ended.
Okay, I live close to Munich.
Ah, okay.
So in the southern part of Germany. Really live close to the Alps and the Austrian border.
Uh-huh. So that's where we were. Then because we had been there so long, we were one of the first ones to be sent home.
Okay. Well, how was it like? Because I read something about Nuremberg that the city didn't gave up that easily. They were fighting till the end. Is it true or what happened?
The fighting wasn't very fierce down around Nuremberg.
Okay. No. So they just waved white flags.
Everybody was slowing down.
Yeah.
And it was just a matter of waiting until it was over. I mean, it was actually knowingly over. At the point, we just had to wait for the call to have somebody sign a surrender. That was all.
Yeah. How do you experience the German people?
I didn't meet many German people. I met a lot of German farmers. Because I didn't fight in the cities. I fought out in the fields.
Yeah,
out in the woods and the fields. So we had three regiments of our division, and one of the regiments did the city fighting, and I didn't do any city fighting.
Yeah. Okay. So you just went out like with your experience out to the fields and forests.
Yes. Yeah.
How did you experience the end of the war? Was it like coming through the radio, or did someone like say like now it's over?
Well, no, we got word from our commander, who was apparently in touch with Eisenhower's office or something like that. It was sort of a verbal. We learned of it verbally, and then we're just a matter of waiting to be picked up and sent home.
Right after or in summer?
We were one of the first troops to be sent home. I was home, I think, in June.
Okay, that's pretty early.
July, because I had a 30-day furlough, and I was back at in a camp in North Carolina on the 15th of August when the Japanese surrendered. So you can see, by August 15th, I had already had a 30-day vacation.
Okay.
So I must have gotten home probably in June.
But that's pretty fair, because you just came on D-Day and then had the first fight.
Yeah.
So that's fair. Mm-hmm. What have you done after the war? Did you like stay in the army, or did you do another job?
I did another job. I had been a newsboy when I grew up, to deliver newspapers for years. So I joined the Boston paper as a manager of one of their branches.
Okay.
And managing 20-odd newsboys. And then my mother heard about a job opening. My mother was worked in a library, and she had a librarian friend that she had luncheon with. And she heard about a position as a salesman in a company. And so I applied for the job and got it. And it was I traveled New England for about 8 years. And then in the same company, they shipped me out to Chicago, where I managed a bigger territory.
Okay.
So I was with them for 20 years or 21 years. And then I decided to go into business myself. And I built what was called an executive search firm. We recruited high-level executives.
Okay, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever been back to Germany and to the Hürtgen Forest?
I haven't seen the Hürtgen Forest. I went back to France.
Couldn't find the Hürtgen. We were there.
Yeah, I know we couldn't. Yeah, my wife just said we couldn't find the Hürtgen. I didn't go back to Germany. No, I went to France. I didn't go back to Germany.
Okay, because I think the Hürtgen Forest has a museum right now, it's a museum somewhere in the Hürtgen
Forest. Oh, is it really?
Yeah, I found it online because I think 2 weeks ago I Googled about the Hürtgen Forest, the findings, and then I found that there's a museum there.
And there's a museum in the Hürtgen?
Yeah, it's close to it. It's called the Hürtgen Forest Museum or something. I can send you the link.
Would you?
We may not be spelling it correctly.
No, she's got H-U-R-T-G-E-N.
Yes, it's called...
That's funny.
It's called, within the U, the points over it, the German Hürtgen, it's called in German.
And you're going to send me a link to it?
Yeah, I can send you the link to the museum, yes.
Great, thank you.
So you can look through. Because I don't know if you know the book, The Rifle?
Is that a movie or something?
Yeah, are you still in contact with Ed Cottrell? Because he went to Germany, I think 2 weeks ago or something. And I think he visited this museum.
Oh, I'm not still in contact with him.
Okay, I think I have to send you the pictures because I saw them on Facebook that he visited the museum in Hürtgen Forest.
Well, I'm not on Facebook. So.
Okay, but I sent you the picture.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and the link to the museum. Larry, if you could describe the war in a few words for the younger generations, which words would you use or pick?
Well, I guess Burns has got it right. It was called a necessary war. If that's Jim Burns, the man that make my contact with you through him?
Yeah.
Yeah. He called it the necessary war.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. I don't like wars.
Yeah.
But they seem to continue, don't they, huh?
Yes, we have the war close here, in the Ukraine. It's pretty close and... Yeah, it starts all over again, maybe.
Now, do you work for a newspaper or
no? I'm a teacher. I work at a school.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, I work in Munich at it's like a high school. It's like grade 5 to grade 10, so the kids are between 10 and 16, 17 years old.
I gotcha.
Yes, and I'm a writer. I write books about World War II. But my main job is being a teacher.
Ah, well, good for you.
Yes, I really like it. I really enjoy teaching. Have you ever been to a school class telling them, the kids, your stories?
No. One time, way back, yes, many years ago.
Okay.
Yes, one time, yeah.
They should be really interested.
Yeah. Well, this was grammar school, many years ago. 10, 15 years ago.
Okay. What advice would you give to the young generation?
Well, I had... Let me switch it. I'm not a good talker. I had a nephew that lived in Arizona. And he wanted his eighth grade class, wanted me to talk to the eighth grade class. And I said, well, I don't know what to talk about. why don't you all send me a set of questions? And then I'll answer those questions, which we did, they did, and it worked out beautifully. I just can't come up with things I want to say, but I'll answer questions.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a talker, though. That's what my wife says, anyway.
So if kids like came up with the, with like, could you give me advice with all your experience? What would you like do again in life, or what's important? What would you say? What's important for you in life?
Yeah. Well, there were just simple questions about this and that. You know, what happened here, what happened there. But it was interesting to them and interesting to me.
Yeah. Can you remember a few questions?
Oh, no. It was many, many years ago.
Okay.
Many years ago. No. But they were very simple questions.
Okay.
They were eighth graders. So they weren't very serious questions. I don't know. Somewhere I probably kept a list of them. I don't know where it is, though. I did write a story about my experiences growing up in the war. And I know that Mr. Burns, when he was here, had made a copy of it, which he has. It was called Buddy Howe. I was called Buddy in those days when I grew up. It was called Buddy Howe, World War II Soldier. And he has a copy of it.
Okay.
Which exposes all my experiences.
Yeah. That's a crazy life you just...
Yeah. Well, it was, I guess, necessary, but it's all over with.
Yeah.
Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve, okay.
This is my story.
All right. We, the Germans and we sent out patrols at night. And around the early to mid-December, we were in Luxembourg, and one of the patrols found a barn near Luxembourg, in Luxembourg, in the suburbs, that was loaded with champagne. So they brought a couple of cases back, because they were met by a jeep who would take them back to our guns. And then, as each night as the patrols went out, they were told to stop by that barn and pick up more champagne. So by Christmas Eve, we had collected enough champagne that two men could share one bottle. And we kept doing it. And then by New Year's Eve, we had a bottle each. And I didn't drink.
What? Larry, meeting the German soldier. You're in one side of the barn and he's in the other.
Oh, yeah. In that barn where the champagne was, the night I was out on patrol, one of the nights I was out on patrol, I went in opened the barn door and went in to get a case. And when I was in there, the barn doors at the other side of the barn opened up and some German soldiers came in. And they grabbed theirs and went one way, and I grabbed mine and went another way.
So you saw each other, or just like they didn't know?
Didn't even wave to each other or anything. We knew what they were after, and they knew what we were after, and that was champagne, not a fight.
Good for the alcohol.
Pardon me?
That's good you guys had alcohol.
Yes.
Alcohol saves lives.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, anyway, I'm glad it's all over, and we're all, and your uncles, your grandfather made it back with them?
Yes, they made it back, and my grandfather, who was a doctor, he wrote a daily diary in World War II, so I still have his diaries.
Oh, good.
Because he made a note each day. He started in 1942. Yeah, he came to the Eastern Front, yes.
Oh boy, wonderful.
Yeah.
And you still have them?
Yeah, I still have them, and he has some maps from Russia, and he made notes in the maps where the companies were stationed.
Oh, so he was on the Eastern Front.
Yes, he was close to Stalingrad. He was in the the tank regiment in the... And he was the doctor there, and my other grandfather was signaler.
Wow. Oh, they were on the other side, okay.
Yeah, they went on, fighting on the Russians.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, my...
Well, this has been a lot of fun.
No, it was not.
Maybe we'll do this again sometime.
Oh, that was fun. Yeah, I thought the war for my grandparents. Yeah, it was great. Maybe we should talk with invite Stephen the next time. He would be really thrilled.
Let's try to do that.
Yeah, he would be really happy.
All right. Well, let's try to set it up, and we'll do it again.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Well, nice talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Larry.
And thanks for your patience. We started talking about this back in January, and now it's April.
Yes, no problem.
I'm a little slow.
No problem.
Okay, well, thanks so much, and enjoyed being with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, and have a good day. It's early.
You too. Thank you so much.
Afternoon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
History Wissen. Heute geht es die Schlacht im Hürtgenwald. Der Hürtgenwald ist ein etwa 20 Kilometer langer Wald, etwa 15 Kilometer südöstlich von Aachen, in der Städteregion Aachen und im Kreis Düren in Nordrhein-Westfalen. Nach der Landung in der Normandie am D-Day kämpften die westlichen Alliierten im Rahmen der Operation Overlord darum, dort eine feste Basis aufzubauen und die Deutschen aus Nordfrankreich zurückzudrängen. Die Alliierten wollten zwischen Aachen und Monschau in einem Waldgebiet bei Hürtgen durchbrechen und entlang der Ruhrfront in der Jülicher Börde stehenden deutschen Verbänden in die Flanke fallen, um ihren Truppen auf dem Weg zum Rhein dort den Stellungskrieg zu ersparen. Sie fürchteten auch eine Überflutung durch Sprengung der Ruhrtalsperre und Flankenangriffe aus der Eifel bei ihrem Vorstoß zum Rhein. Deshalb versuchten die Amerikaner einen Angriff durch die Bergregion, ohne sich über die Gegebenheiten in diesem unwegsamen Gelände im Klaren zu sein. Am Vormittag des 6. Oktober 1944 beginnt der Vormarsch der zur 1. US-Armee gehörenden 9. US-Infanteriedivision unter dem Oberbefehl des 5. US-Korps gegen die deutsche 275. Infanteriedivision auf der gesamten Breite des Angriffsgeländes. In diesem Waldgebiet gelingt es jedoch kaum, Ziele für die alliierte Artillerie und Luftwaffe auszumachen. Größtenteils macht das Gelände den Einsatz schwerer Fahrzeuge unmöglich, weil die wenigen Wege für schwere Fahrzeuge kaum oder gar nicht geeignet sind. Weitere Probleme für die US-Truppen sind die genauen Ortskenntnis der Wehrmacht und deren sorgfältige Vorbereitungen von Feuerplänen und Stellungen für Artillerie, Mörser und MGs. Die Verteidiger sind durch das berge und waldige Gelände im Vorteil, das die amerikanische Überlegenheit an Kriegsgerät weniger zur Geltung kommen lässt. Außerdem stehen ihnen die Befestigungen des Westwalls zur Verfügung. Die US-Soldaten sind somit dazu gezwungen, einen Grabenkrieg zu führen, der für beide Seiten sehr kräftezehrend ist. Dabei wirkt sich erschwerend aus, dass die Amerikaner praktisch überhaupt keine Erfahrungen im Gebirgs- und Kleinkrieg besitzen, wenn die Deutschen durch die Erfahrungen der vergangenen Kriegsjahre bereits damit vertraut sind. Viele ältere Offiziere haben auch noch Erfahrungen aus dem Stellungskrieg im Ersten Weltkrieg. Im Wald- und Bergland gibt es nur wenige Ansatzpunkte für die Luftwaffe und gepanzerte Fahrzeuge, sodass die Infanterie die Hauptlast der Kämpfe trägt. Die Deutschen verwandeln den dichten Wald mit unzähligen Schützenlöchern, Gräben und dem massiven Einsatz von Minen in eine Festung. In den Bäumen versteckte Scharfschützen, sogenannte Baumschützen, fordern einen stetigen Blutzoll. Baumkrepierer, das heißt Artilleriegranaten, die so eingestellt werden, dass sie in Baumwipfelhöhe detonieren und somit den Boden noch zusätzlich mit Holzsplittern übersehen, erweisen sich als sehr gefährlich für die ohne ausreichende Deckung vorgehenden Angreifer. Teilweise schießt die deutsche Artillerie mit Granaten, die einen Doppel- oder Zeitzünder besitzen und noch in der Luft detonieren, was die Splitterwirkung im Vergleich zu herkömmlichen Granaten mit Aufschlagzündern um das anderthalbfache erhöht. So bleibt der Angriff im Wald stecken und die Höhen bleiben in deutscher Hand, obwohl sich die Amerikaner den Gegebenheiten recht schnell anpassen. Die Deutschen haben Nachschubschwierigkeiten. Die kämpfenden Verbände haben auf dem Rückzug durch Frankreich schwere Verluste erlitten und der Ersatz ist kaum verfügbar. Durch den Mangel an Treibstoff und Fahrzeugen muss der Nachschub im unwegsamen Gelände oft von Trägerkolonnen nach vorn gebracht werden. Nach 10 Tagen schwerer Kämpfe sind beide Seiten so geschwächt, dass die Kampfhandlungen abflauen. Am Ende der erfolglosen Offensive beträgt der Geländegewinn der Amerikaner etwa 2,7 Kilometer. Die Verluste betragen 4.500 Mann. Die Deutschen verlieren etwa 3.200 Mann. Im Herbst und Winter 44-45 kommen in der Nordeifel geschätzt 25.000 bis 30.000 US-amerikanische und deutsche Soldaten ums Leben. Auch heute noch trifft man auf Spuren der Schlacht, auf Bunkerruinen, Munitionsreste, Stellungsgräben und Spuren von Panzerketten. Eine verwundete Landschaft, die von einem bisher kaum bekannten Kapitel des Zweiten Weltkriegs erzählt. Für die US-Truppen ist der Hürtgen Forest das letzte Hindernis auf dem Weg zum Rhein und zum Ruhrgebiet. Doch die Entscheidung im September 1944, ausgerechnet durch diesen dichten Wald vorzurücken, erweist sich als verhängnisvoller Fehler. Die Amerikaner schätzen das unwegsame Gebiet der Nordeifel völlig falsch ein. Sie verlieren die Orientierung und die deutsche Wehrmacht verwandelt den Wald mit Schützengräben und tausenden Minen in eine regelrechte Festung. Dazu kommen Dauerregen und Nebel, dann Schnee und eisige Kälte. Der Schriftsteller Ernest Hemingway, der 18 Tage im Hürtgenwald an vorderster Front war, schrieb später, Zitat: Eine Gegend, in der es äußerst schwierig war, am Leben zu bleiben, selbst wenn man nichts weiter tat, als dort zu sein. Am Ende war die 9. US-Division durch die sehr harten Waldgefechte abgekämpft und wurde am 26. Oktober 1944 durch die 28. Infanteriedivision ersetzt. Der Anblick der schmutzig und abgerissen aussehenden Soldaten der abgelösten Einheit beeinträchtigt den Kampfgeist der weitgehend unerfahrenen Einsatztruppen. Das US-Oberkommando will keine Zeit verlieren und plant einen Angriff auf das Dorf Schmidt, das als Kreuzungspunkt vieler Wege und durch seine Höhenlage im sogenannten Stolberg-Korridor taktisch und operativ wichtig ist. Der Angriffstermin wird auf den 31. Oktober angesetzt, muss aber wegen schlechten Wetters auf den 2. November verschoben werden. Die 28. Infanteriedivision wird dabei um zusätzliche Pionier-, Panzer- und Artillerieeinheiten verstärkt, die beim Durchbruch helfen sollen. Im Tal des Flüsschens Kall, nahe der sogenannten Mestringer Mühle, entbrennt ein Dschungelkampf, bei dem ein normaler Frontverlauf schwerlich zu erkennen ist. Freund und Feind liegen sich auf engstem Raum gegenüber und kämpfen verbissen, Mann gegen Mann. Die Verluste auf beiden Seiten sind erheblich. Die Versorgung von Verwundeten ist in dem schwer zugänglichen Gelände für beide Seiten nahezu unmöglich. Hilferufe aus diesem Kampfgebiet lassen Schlimmes erahnen. In dieser ausweglosen Situation entschließt sich Dr. Stüttgen, durch unmittelbare Verhandlungen mit dem Gegner 3-mal eine Feuerpause zu vereinbaren, damit beide Seiten Verwundete versorgen und ihre Gefallenen bergen können. Jüngste Schätzungen gehen etwa von 10.000 Deutschen und 30.000 amerikanischen Toten im Hürtgenwald aus, was für so ein kleines Gebiet eine enorme Zahl ist. Bis heute gelten noch hunderte von Soldaten beider Seiten als vermisst. Und noch immer werden Knochenreste gefunden. Ich bin sehr dankbar, dass ich noch die Möglichkeit hatte, mit Larry über seine Erlebnisse im Hürtgenwald zu sprechen. Er ist einer der letzten Überlebenden und Zeitzeugen, die von dieser Zeit und von diesen Kampfhandlungen berichten können. Da Larrys Generation Jahr für Jahr, Monat für Monat ausstirbt, ist es umso wichtiger, ihre Geschichten einzufangen und somit am Leben zu halten. Larry war ein sehr positiver und außerordentlich optimistischer Mensch, der als junger Soldat die Hölle erlebt hat. Ihm war es immer wichtig, an die Schrecken erinnern zu können, um den Krieg vermeiden zu können. Wenn auch du dir Larrys Geschichte angehört hast, dann gehörst auch du zu den Zeitzeugen, die dazu beitragen, dass die Vergangenheit nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Somit trägst auch du einen Teil der Flamme weiter. Wenn du den Podcast gerne unterstützen möchtest, dann lass unbedingt ein Abo und eine positive Bewertung da. Außerdem kannst du meinen Instagram- oder WhatsApp-Kanal abonnieren, um mehr über die Folgen und meine Recherche zu erfahren. Genauere Infos dazu packe ich dir in die Shownotes. Sei das nächste Mal auch wieder mit dabei, wenn es heißt Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg.